Well, it's a great pleasure, really, to give a talk in my own university, especially on a sunny day, and thank you very much, given the sunshine. Cateris Paribus, I really appreciate you coming. I think of this as a really important topic. I hope you will share that view, and maybe even with luck, share some of my conclusions. You can see this is work with Danny Blanchflower, a long-standing co-author. As probably most people here know, if we go back to the 1950s and the 1960s, the unemployment rate in our kinds of countries, in Western Europe, OECD more generally, the unemployment rate was far, far lower. This is in some sense before your time as an economist, but this was a world where we worried a lot about 4% unemployment. Why do we care about unemployment? Because we know it's associated with a huge amount of mental ill health, a huge amount of unhappiness and insecurity, and of course a lot of opportunity cost of GDP, you might say, a lot of lost income. Today, in the OECD, the unemployment rate's about 10%. In the euro area, it's now over 12%, and probably we have people here from Spain and Italy and Greece and countries of that kind where, I'm sorry to say, in some cases, nearly one quarter of the workforce, one quarter is out of work. And once upon a time, we didn't think that a safe society in the West could survive that kind of joblessness. The standard explanations you've probably been exposed to, and you may have even been taught by Jeremy here, for all I know, those explanations. The standard view is that trade unions became, over the few decades since the Second World War, too powerful. The labor market became too inflexible in various kinds of ways, and unemployment benefits, that is the subsidy to unemployment, UI, unemployment insurance, an American would call it, was too generous, became too generous. Now, if we really understand unemployment, and these are the reasons, then of course that's very important. But there are powerful reasons to think that we don't understand this well. First, at a simple anecdotal level, we've implemented over the last few decades, as I've gone from my 30s into almost my 60s, I can't believe it, we have implemented across the Western nations really quite draconian policies often to reduce the generosity of unemployment insurance. The position has changed dramatically in Great Britain. We now have, by many standards, really rather stingy financial support for those who are out of work. We've greatly weakened, partly on purpose and partly accidentally, the power of trade unions. And in a whole host of ways, it appears anyway that we have reduced the inflexibility of labor markets. Now, some of the unemployment that we see around us, of course, is part of the giant up and down cycle of any economy. And we're not trying today, Blanchflower and I, are not trying today to solve what we might call Keynesian unemployment shocks. No doubt it would be great if we could understand those better, but I want to look behind the numbers and think much more about the steady state, the U star level. Think of a giant difference equation written out in long run equilibrium. I want to think about the natural rate of unemployment, in other words. What shapes that? And the punchline is this. I'm hoping everyone has a hard copy of the paper. I'll look at a few tables if I may, but here's the notion. Just like in the case of the human body, if you go into your doctor and you have a pain in your right shoulder, that doesn't mean that the problem for your body is located in the right shoulder. The body is a general equilibrium system where we have very complex interdependence, and the heart of a problem, the nub of a problem, can appear to be very different from where the symptom is. So I want to argue, of course it won't be a shock to you if you've done some general equilibrium theory, and you will have done, it's not a conceptual complete shock to think that maybe we might find the heart of the unemployment problem not in the labor market. All these major markets link up in the GE system, and I want to argue that a huge part, I reckon, of the unemployment we see around us in our kinds of countries that is causing tremendous unhappiness and mental ill health is caused by the housing market's function itself. I'm going to start more broadly, but just before I do, let me tell you the punchlines in detail. Although I've started talking about our kinds of nations, the problem with doing really persuasive empirical science on our nations is there aren't many countries. The statistical power is low. They differ in lots of complicated ways. They have different institutions. So the bulk of this paper, with my colleague, takes the states of the USA as a sort of mini laboratory, and it looks over many, many decades at the unemployment rate in one state, Tennessee, to New Hampshire, to California. In other words, we're going to look a lot today at panels of US states through time, in some cases up to 50 years of the US states. So we've got 50 states times certainly many decades. It depends on exactly which data we're looking at. And we show that when you allow for some lags, a rise in the home ownership rate in a state is a predictor of, a few years later, of a huge rise in the unemployment rate. When home ownership in a state rises, if you follow the data through a few years later, there is a huge rise proportionally in the unemployment rate. You've all learned lots of economics, so the first thing that should come into your mind is, should I really believe this man? And the second thing is, if I did, how big is the elasticity anyway? The elasticity on our estimates is between 1 and 1.5, maybe 2. Okay, think about what that implies if it's correct. If the home ownership rate doubles, that will more than double the rate of unemployment. If this claim is true, it's either true or it's either false or it's important, and we have to get to the bottom of it. And now's a very good time for questions. It looks like there are some.
Do you have an idea what the mechanism behind
that is? A very good question, yes. I'm going to show you three kinds of potential mechanisms, although the honest answer is that I don't know. But we'll look at equations for three kinds of mechanisms. First, we'll show as the home ownership rate rises in a state, the rate of labor mobility falls off. That's true even when we control for whether the individuals are homeowners or renters. In other words, there's evidence consistent with some sort of externality from the home ownership rate in Warwickshire onto your labor mobility, or maybe incomers' labor mobility. Second, we show that when home ownership rates rise, the commuting time to work goes up. That's presumably because there's congestion, we're all getting in each other's way, raising the costs of labor and our own costs of getting to work. And finally, we show all these things are controlling for state fixed effects, I should explain. And finally, if the home ownership rate rises in an area, there is a drop in the number of new firms, there's a drop in the rate of business formation. So we have three potential mechanisms. I cannot today, perhaps I should explain, this paper's not quite ready to submit. I cannot today knit them all together into a perfect interlocking puzzle, all made up. But those are the three bits. Worse labor mobility, if I'm allowed to be pejorative. Worse commuting times, and worse business formation rates. Maybe the latter coming through so-called NIMBY effects, not in my backyard effects, where we know homeowners, of course, are a very powerful lobby, and it's in their direct interest to block a lot of new business in their local area, though we cannot prove, I'm afraid, that that's the mechanism. May I just whiz through a couple of methodological points? I'd like to talk about how you might use different kinds of statistical evidence, and I'm going to illustrate that, if I may, from another part of research, one that you probably won't be very familiar with, starting with this. Can anybody tell me what the initials BMJ stand for? I don't know how many Brits I've got in the audience. The British Medical Journal, that's right, a very famous medical journal. And in 1948, the BMJ published this paper, which is really a landmark paper, very important even to you, though you probably have no idea what this paper did. Have you? The people who took part in it will always remember it because they had a large needle inserted deep into their bottoms. This is the first randomized controlled trial in medicine or behavioral science or social science we believe ever published. This 1948 paper was a landmark paper. It was not fully double-blind or placebo, but it, as you can imagine, it's a very important paper. And it showed that streptomycin, which is a kind of antibiotic, if injected deep inside you, could help tuberculosis, which of course was a real killer disease in that era. A couple of years later, a more important paper was published, and this one you may know much more about. And the point I'd like to make here is that this did not use RCT methods. That is, it did not use randomized trials. You probably realize that today I'm not going to use randomized trials, at least not in a direct way. One that changed the world, and it was published by this man, who died a few years ago. You probably have no idea who this is, but I wonder if anybody knows, now I put up his name, what he did. Any idea? This man changed your life. He fundamentally changed Western society and the lives of everybody in the room. Okay, this is the paper that was published by Richard Doll. He was a very young man in smoking and carcinoma of the lung. This was the first published evidence that smoking causes lung cancer. What he did was he went to, with his colleague Bradford Hill, he went to London hospitals and collected data on 700 lung cancer patients, 700, and then he collected data on 700 matched controls, matched in the sense of age and a few other things. He had no regression equations, but that's sort of what he was trying to do. He was trying to do a cross-section analysis, and in a sense, he did that. He called this a case control. And what he found was, comparing his 700 lung cancer people, he was actually partitioning on the dependent variable. He did all sorts of things we might not want to do. He found that the relative risk went up like this of his 700 lung cancer people. What they were interviewed about their lifestyles, and this is what he found. His theory before had been that the tremendous rise in lung cancer between the First World War and the Second World War was caused by tar macadam on the roads. He knew that when you lay tar macadam on roads, there'd been a huge amount of road building, of course there's a lot of fumes, and his theory was that that is what had produced the dramatic rise in male lung cancer in Great Britain and around the world. But of course, he and Hill decided that it was smoking that caused lung cancer. And in 1950, they published that. Then they published two more papers. These really have changed Western society, you understand. You can't smoke in this building, or even close to the building, probably, because of this man. These were so-called prospective studies. In other words, he'd get a lot of data on doctors. It was much harder in that era to get data on random samples. But he got doctors to record how much they smoked and then trace those doctors through their lives. And he watched those who fell off the perch early, that is, who died or contracted lung cancer. A huge row then broke out. And I imagine, possibly Marcus might know what happened after the early lung cancer papers were published, but almost no economist knows this bit of history in my experience. A huge row broke out caused by Ronald Fisher. That is not Ronald Fisher, that is some man in a bobble hat. But you can see if you read the, it's not a tombstone, but if you read the plaque, you can see that, you know he's a good statistician because he lived exactly 2 standard deviations more than the mean expected lifespan for somebody born in 1890. And there he is. I remind you, in case you don't know, that Fisher was the most important statistician in Britain at that time, very possibly the most important statistician in the world at that time. Incredibly famous, he developed the F test, that's where the F comes from, maximum likelihood, a lot about the analysis of variance, a lot about what would become called, though he didn't use those words, non-parametric statistics, and tons of other stuff. I like this picture on the web with him smoking because it might give you a clue to what's coming next. Fisher immediately went into print saying that Doll was wrong. Doll was a young man. Now imagine you're in his shoes. The most famous statistician in England goes into print saying that you're wrong. And he made fun of Doll, always a very difficult strategy to deal with as a researcher. He showed a time series correlation of apple imports into Britain and the rise in divorce and said, this is what happens when foolish young men take too much account of correlations. And then he published in Nature. You probably realize it was then the most important journal in the world. Arguably, it still is the most important journal in the world. He published a study of twins. He was far ahead of his time methodologically in thinking that twins would make a natural, you might say, laboratory setting, concluding that smoking was harmless. He had 5 reasons, and you see them every day, and you're taught them as a kind of checklist of when you should reject a paper or an idea. He said, well, there must be omitted variables. He thought that genes, he was a very prominent geneticist, there must be a genetic explanation, a certain kind of genes makes Andrew smoke. and that gene or something correlated with that gene in the genetic system, he didn't know much about the genetic system, must be correlated with the illness and the smoking. Cancer maybe causes smoking, a little bit in your very sensible reaction. He said, well, maybe cancer causes smoking. He said, if you look at the secular trend data, it doesn't match Dole's claims. That wasn't really true, but that's what he said, and today I'm not going to debate the details. He said there are too many anomalies in the data because Dole and Hill had you should read the BMJ paper, really. It's such an important methodological paper. They listed all their data and patterns in a very honest way, including some anomalies, and they showed that those who inhaled were less likely to get cancer. This has never been explained to this day why that would be, but they published the results, and of course, their critics went right for it. This did not make sense, right? That the inhalers get cancer less. And finally, Richard Dole has no theory. Now, you see these criticisms, as I said, every time you go to seminars or you see those who are frightened of the potential criticisms. Now, you know the answer, of course, because this is 2013, but put yourself back in 1950, 1953, 1954. Fisher, the greatest statistician of the age, possibly over the last 100 years, turned out to be wrong, disastrously wrong. All his arguments were absolutely correct, logically, as possibilities, and this is why I'm going through this, just generally, because you have grown up in a world where you're taught that, in a sense, quite rightly, if there's a potential flaw in the causality logic, then you should be extremely hostile to the claim. And you are right at some level to be extremely hostile to the claim. But unfortunately, we also have, as researchers, to learn to sift weaker evidence and not just to go through a checklist in our mind where we block down incredibly important ideas. I'm sure it's obvious to you that if the world had listened to Fisher's complaints about endogeneity, these essentially things like endogeneity, millions more people would have died prematurely, millions. Now, I haven't got an answer for you or for myself about how to deal with all of this, except just I think it's worth bearing in mind that there are many ways to learn about the world without randomized trials, and some of the most important public health discoveries were made that way. One reaction is you could... He died never changing his mind, by the way. Fisher refused to adapt to the evidence, even though it had built up for another 20 years. You could go to Max Planck's famous statement that people never change their minds, they just die. That's how new ideas take over. My experience, I'd be interested in some of the older researchers' views in the audience. My instinct is that's very, very true. And I suppose it's true of me too, right? But we have to try to guard against it. And more broadly, a bit of humility is sensible for my age, your age, any age, in how to sift different kinds of evidence. Now let's go back to economics, and I'm going to start with some simple correlations. There's 27 dots here. It's not a lot of statistical power, but you can see that I'm interested in the cross-section correlation here between home ownership in different Western countries and the unemployment rate. And in my haste with the lecture preparation, I left out Switzerland, and I'm pleased to tell you that Switzerland has, does anybody know what the home ownership rate is? The home ownership rate in Switzerland is 35%, and its unemployment rate is about 3.5%. In other words, it's about here. Now, this is not serious evidence for a behavioral relationship. What might we object to? This is liable to be dominated by country-fixed effects. All sorts of unobservables might well be generating this relationship. Say we think about differencing out fixed effects and leave the setting of different countries behind and go to the states of the USA. That appeals to me. I'd be interested in your view intrinsically more because I think that way we have got, there's a sense in which we've got a fairer laboratory setting, more homogeneity, more background homogeneity than we have between Greece, say, and Switzerland, and so on. Let's look at the 50-year changes. And here, because I want to argue that there are some years go by before home ownership has its bad effect on the unemployment rate, here, we've just looked at the lowest change in home ownership rate states, and the five highest home ownership rate change states over half a century. So the mean growth in home ownership is 23 percentage points, and this is essentially zero. And you can see that the change in the unemployment rate is about 3 percentage points or so. I mean, that's a huge amount. Now, I'll just say one thing, and then we'll look at more serious evidence. Is there any experimental evidence? Because despite my appeal to the power of Doll's argument, we shouldn't forget that what we really need is clear causality, if we can possibly get it. And a paper's just been released by Laamanen in Finland. We communicated and decided we'd go public, roughly speaking, together a week or two ago. And Laamanen, although he has in some ways worse data than we do, in other ways he has a fantastic advantage scientifically, because he has a deregulation in the housing market that spread across Finland at different speeds in different regions. And he finds the same results. I wonder if you could turn to chart two. Oh gosh, yes, I can't. Chart two in the hard copy paper. If you don't have a hard copy paper, could you raise your hand? If you'd like one and don't have it, okay, because we got tons. Neil, could you, there's a couple of chaps behind you. We're going to look at some of these tables because they're too detailed to put on a slide. Now, if you turn to chart two, where I think the photocopying makes it a little bit of an intellectual challenge to work your way through, is chart two, the change in, chart two, which is on page, can you possibly tell me? Tell me again?
25.
Chart two on page 25 plots the long changes. Now, this is for the whole sample of US states, still just 50 dots, chart two. This is nice in the sense that we have differenced out state fixed effects, but in other ways, of course, it's incredibly simple evidence, to put it mildly, and you can't, in your master's thesis, appeal much to such evidence, although the older you get, the more you will start your papers with a simple plot of this kind. There's a prediction. Then we do the obvious sorts of things. We estimate unemployment panels. We have annual data for relatively long samples, maybe 30 years. So we know the state, of course. We have plenty of microdata, millions of randomly sampled Americans. We estimate unemployment equations, generally with lag-dependent variables, but without, just to show the American readers. And we find that around T minus one in the home ownership rate, very little is happening. If you look back a few years, you find that movements in the home ownership rate a few years ago are generating, with a huge elasticity, correlations, upward correlations in the unemployment rate. Needless to say, we're controlling for, apart from state fixed effects and year dummies, the educational qualifications of the representative citizens in the state, gender, and so on, race. Why is that convincing? We had to do a bunch of checks before I was willing to go public on it. So I don't know how much you're taught such checks, but I'll tell you the ones that I tend to go through before I go into the public domain with work. First of all, I like to see my claims fit on different sub-periods of the data. So one of the early checks was we just split the data in the middle. We have about 30 years, so take about 15 years and about 15 years, and estimate the model on the two halves. And that works fine. We still get T minus three, T minus four, T minus five home ownership rates coming through strongly positive with a huge elasticity. Another natural thing to worry about is, my picture is gone, but if you remember the home ownership rises and flat home ownership rate states, the South is very heavily represented. The South of the United States is very heavily represented in one class. So maybe there's some sort of omitted variable corresponding to the South of the USA. The next check then we do in the paper is we separate into the Northern states and the Southern states. And again, we replicate the same pattern. That doesn't mean we have nailed down causality, but it does mean that there's a pattern you might want to take seriously. Then we go to our labor mobility rates, and we show that as home ownership rises, labor mobility falls. We go to commuting time equations. We have data on about 7 million randomly sampled Americans who report their commuting times, and home ownership worsens or raises their commute times. Again, controlling for state effects, of course. And finally, the result on the rate of firm formation. I'm minded to stop there, actually. Of course, I can talk very happily for at least 2 hours about this topic, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like me to do such a thing. But I think it's sensible at this point to just throw it open for somewhat early questions. If there's anything you'd like to ask or say, you're very welcome.